Good day, everyone, and welcome once again to the audio portion of the Journal of Lancaster General Hospital. I'm Larry Bonchek, and as always, thank you for listening. This edition is consistent with our effort to bring you a CD each time that contains one conversation about a clinical topic that is directly relevant to the care of patients, and another that ranges more widely and is of general interest. One category of the latter that I have been conducting includes conversations with senior members of the Lancaster General medical and administrative staffs about the history of the hospital. In the last issue, I spoke with Dr. Dick Weber about his view of Lancaster General through the years since he came here as an intern in the 1960s. In the current CD, I talk with Dr. Jimmy Argiers about his experiences as this medical community developed while he was developing the neurosurgery program. In our clinical interview, I speak with Dr. Rupal Dumasia, an interventional cardiologist who has recently joined the Heart Group. We discuss one of the most pressing current topics in medicine, the changing perspectives on coronary stents, particularly drug-eluting stents. These have now been found to have a higher incidence of late complications than had been previously realized, and the indications for their use are being reassessed. Rupal, welcome to our microphone.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, although you're a young man, you have quite an impressive background and training experience, which I'd like to summarize very briefly. You actually grew up not far from here in South Jersey, graduated from high school in Toms River in 1992 as valedictorian. You then graduated in 1995 from a special program at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, which provided you not only with a BS in chemical biology after 3 years, again as valedictorian, but it gave you the opportunity to coordinate with the medical school program for the next 4 years at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, where you were, we now could presume, Alpha Omega Alpha. So in 7 years, you got through college and medical school in a combined program with honors. And then your postdoctoral training was also absolutely first rate with an internship and residency in medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, followed by your cardiology fellowship at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor with a special fellowship, again at Michigan for another year in interventional cardiology, all concluding in 2006. And then I understand you practiced solo in Toms River before coming here with the Heart Group this year. And they, I know, are delighted, as are all of us on the medical staff, that you and your wife decided to come to Lancaster. Now, your CV is filled with multiple awards and honors, and I'm not going to list them, but they certainly reflect your outstanding performance and character from high school up to now. And I know that we're going to have a very interesting discussion about what I think everyone would agree, is a very hot topic right now and a potentially confusing one. Coronary stents. They've been very much in the news lately, and I'm sure almost everyone's aware, at least vaguely, that the use of stents, and particularly drug-eluting stents, has come under considerable reconsideration because of reports that have emerged about late complications, and especially stent thrombosis. So, if you would, just by way of introduction, if you could just summarize for us how we got where we are in the treatment of coronary artery disease. All we had was coronary bypass when I was a resident in the late 60s. And then Andreas Grunzig came along from Zurich with his conceptual breakthrough of using a balloon catheter, and he presented 4 patients at the American Heart Association meeting in 1977. How did he get to that idea of the balloon catheter?
Well, Charles Dotter's technique was that of inserting serial dilators in the periphery. Now, that would be very difficult, or if not impossible, to translate to the coronary vasculature. And so Grundzig, while he knew these techniques and was intimately familiar with these techniques, knew that it would not work in the coronaries and had to devise something else. And so he fashioned his own catheters, namely balloon catheters. These balloon catheters were very rudimentary catheters that were attached to guide wires that were fixed to the catheter rather than a separate wire and balloon as we use today.
Well, let me ask you to explain the mechanisms by which inflating a balloon in an atherosclerotic vessel that's only a couple millimeters works to enlarge the lumen.
Well, there are a couple of mechanisms by which it works. One is that the plaque is compressed against the wall. Another is that the plaque moves along the vessel longitudinally. Now, one of the untoward effects of balloon angioplasty is that it creates a dissection. It is not always an angiographically visible dissection, but by intravascular ultrasound, if you were to do intravascular ultrasound on everybody on whom you did balloon angioplasty, you would invariably find a dissection. And sometimes this fools us because we see contrast down the vessel in a dissection plane, but not in the lumen. But this is one of the problems with balloon angioplasty.
And you don't always know that you're in a dissection plane. When you look at the angiogram, it makes the vessel look bigger than it actually is.
That's exactly right. It's not until you really have a very significant dissection that contrast begins to stain the deeper layers of the vessel wall. If you have just disruption of the intima, which is one of the big problems with balloon angioplasty, you can have a dissection and not even know it.
Well, now, as a surgeon, when you talk about disruption of the intima to me, we know that any time you damage intima of arteries, coronary or elsewhere, the body reacts, and it reacts by forming scar tissue, for one, and it also forms thrombus on damaged intima. So those clearly are a substrate or a precursor for restenosis of the vessel, I would think.
Right, and that goes right to the heart of the two main problems with balloon angioplasty as a standalone procedure. One, flow-limiting dissection leading to a thrombus and acute closure of the vessel, and two, restenosis. Restenosis rarely kills anybody, but it does cause repeat angina, and so in a lot of ways you're back to where you started.
And the reintervention rate after balloon angioplasty is extremely high.
It's very high. At 6 months, depending on the patient and the lesion, it can be up to 40%.
Yeah, it was so common back then that as surgeons, we used to refer to those patients as having been tagged and thrown back in. It's like when you catch a fish that's below the limit, but you just need to have them grow a little more, and you'll catch them next season.
Well, that's exactly right. And even more importantly than that, in the era of balloon angioplasty as a standalone procedure, this is before stents, about 5% of patients would go to the operating room on an emergent basis due to abrupt closure. The importance of emergency bypass surgery standby really came from that era.
We both recall some of the blind alleys that medical science went down in an effort to resolve this problem of restenosis. Blind alleys until stenting came along and basically pushed aside all these other unsatisfactory ways. But just very briefly, if you would, for a historical perspective, if you could just mention some of these approaches that were taken and proved ineffective in the long run.
Well, there were three major techniques that were developed to fight restenosis. One of them was directional atherectomy, which I'll just briefly mention because it really had no impact and in fact isn't really used today. But that's a technique in which an attempt is made to cut the plaque, store it in a nose cone, and then retract the catheter. Another technique was rotational atherectomy. And I want to spend a little bit more time on this because we still do use it to some extent, although in a different way from which it was used initially. In this technique, a diamond-coated, olive-shaped device is passed across the lesion It rotates very rapidly and abrades the plaque in a differential way, such that the hardened surface is abraded and the softer adjacent surface is not abraded.
Now, this is the roto-rooter, as it's colloquially referred to.
That's exactly right. And what we learned over several years of research is that we initially were using it incorrectly. So it became apparent that this was not the answer. The third technique, again, not used at all anymore in the coronaries, but is used in the periphery, is laser. And interestingly enough, laser, balloon angioplasty, and rotational atherectomy were compared in one trial, all head-to-head, called the Urbach trial, in which, in fact, the ablative techniques, laser and rotational atherectomy, fared worse than balloon angioplasty alone.
Well, they are absolutely effective ways of completely destroying the intima. And when you destroy the intima, as we've already said, you are provoking a healing process that is not controllable.
That's exactly right, and that brings us to stents. The idea behind the stent is that stents come pre-mounted on a balloon. You advance it to the area of the blockage. You blow up the balloon, thereby deploying the stent, deflate the balloon, withdraw the balloon, and what you have left is the stent. The basic idea here is to stabilize the intima, which you have disrupted with a balloon catheter, as in most cases, we pre-dilate the lesion. And secondly, we prevent elastic recoil of the vessel, which is a problem with balloon angioplasty. Stents were first introduced in 1994. That is to say that they were FDA approved for use in the United States in 1994. At least in man, the first stent was deployed in France by Ulrich Sigwart in 1986. Through further refinements, we came to 1994, where we had a balloon expandable stent that was marketed by Johnson & Johnson, and that's really where our recent history began.
Now, stents, of course, did change our lives as heart surgeons, because they pretty much eliminated that emergency component of the patient population. You had said before about 5% of patients would go to the operating room emergently after balloon angioplasty. And stenting virtually eliminated that by eliminating the acute elastic recoil, which is sort of a fancy term for spasm. Yet, stents did not really solve all the problems.
That's exactly right, because we substituted one disease process for another. That is, that stents restenose as well, although to a lesser degree. So the initial studies, stents were compared to balloon angioplasty. There was a 30 to 50% decrease in angiographic restenosis, so a significant improvement. So this represents the first therapy that actually made a dent in restenosis caused by balloon angioplasty. Now remember, the initial indication for stents was really the bailout indication. That is, if you got yourself into trouble. Then as we learned more about stents, we realized that stents actually do cause a decrease in restenosis. Over the years, stents have improved, and now we have drug-eluting stents.
Well, before we go on to drug-eluting stents, I'd only like to point out that when you put a metal stent into a blood vessel, you're still putting a foreign body into the blood vessel. So it is not surprising that stents, although they can enlarge a vessel and prevent the elastic recoil of the vessel, and they can hold the vessel open until hopefully the stented area re-endothelializes and the stent could get incorporated into the healing tissue, it's not surprising that the healing process is sometimes over-exuberant and the vessel could narrow down again. And I guess that led to the idea that maybe we could manipulate the healing process.
Well, that's exactly right. We think of restenosis and study restenosis as if it were a dichotomous process. That is, you either have it or you don't have it. That is not at all how restenosis works, particularly in-stent restenosis. In-stent restenosis, as you point out, is an exuberant re-endothelialization. The way we study this, we look at this as binary restenosis is the very commonly used terminology in the literature. That is, a greater than 50% reduction in lumen diameter at the pre-specified angiographic follow-up. But that's not how it works. Everybody has restenosis to some extent. It's just that when it becomes a flow-limiting problem, that's when it grabs our attention clinically. And so you see in some of the literature the terminology late loss. And that's actually probably a better way of looking at restenosis. So that difference, so how much lumen we're losing, that's late loss. There is one caveat to that, and that is that at very low levels of late loss, it does not correlate with clinical restenosis, which is when your patient comes back with a recurrence of symptoms. Let me clarify that. With bare metal stents, if you compare the lumen initially, immediately after stenting with the lumen at, say, 6 months, what you may find is that the diameter has decreased by about a millimeter. A stent that gives you a late loss of, say, about a millimeter versus a stent that gives you a late loss of about of 1.3 or 1.4 millimeters, you will see a clinical difference. Now, with drug-eluting stent, late loss is so low, whether it's 0.3 millimeters or 0.7 millimeters, clinically that may not make a difference.
Well, let me restate that just to be sure the point is clear. It's really simple mathematics. If you have a change in lumen diameter of 1 millimeter versus a change of 1.5 millimeters, that is a 50% difference, and it is a clinically significant difference because of its impact on blood flow through the vessel. But if you have a reduction in stenosis by the drug-eluting stent to a level of 0.2 millimeters, as opposed to 0.3 millimeters, those differences also constitute a 50% difference, but they have no clinical significance. So in fact, because the drug-eluting stent reduces the magnitude of loss severalfold, they constituted a major improvement in controlling the healing process.
That's exactly right.
Now, how and why do they do that?
Well, there are two drug-eluting stents on the market today. There will soon be a third, but let's talk about the ones that are on the market today. There's a sirolimus-eluting stent and a paclitaxel-eluting stent.
Let me interrupt for a moment and point out that the way they work is that there's a polymer coating on the metal stent that contains the drug, and it's designed to release the drug slowly over a certain time course, and that's all part of the difference between different drug-eluting stents.
There is a difference in the elution profile between the sirolimus-eluting stent and the paclitaxel-eluting stent. With the sirolimus-eluting stent, 85% of the drug is released within the first 30 days, and no further drug is released after 90 days. With the paclitaxel-eluting stent, there's a burst release within the first 48 hours, and thereafter there's a slow release over the first 10 days, and then no further release after 30 days. So the way sirolimus works is that it enters cytosol of the cells, in this case, say, smooth muscle cells, and it basically arrests the proliferation of cells. The long and short of it is it prevents DNA replication, which is obviously a needed step. Paclitaxel works in a slightly different way, and that is after DNA has already been replicated. So basically, these drugs work at different stages in the cell cycle.
Functionally, they both inhibit cell division.
Correct.
But they function at different stages in the replication process.
That's correct.
But they are designed to prevent proliferation of smooth muscle cells. And how long does it take for the paclitaxel to elute?
About 6 months.
So it's considerably longer than the 1 month or so of sirolimus.
Right.
Does that have any functional consequence in terms of their effectiveness?
In terms of the clinical effectiveness, there has been no study to date that would suggest that one is more or less effective than the other. Restenosis with drug-eluting stents is in the single digits, so considerably less than 10%.
All right, so at first it seemed as if we had really solved the problem. But recent experience indicates that we were too optimistic. So what exactly has been happening?
Well, the restenosis problem really has been improved, but the big problem that we face is stent thrombosis. The concept of stent thrombosis has always been with us. It's not a problem that is isolated to drug-eluting stents. Bare metal stents can thrombose as well. Post-angioplasty vessels can thrombose as well. However, we thought we had an excellent device with no problems associated with it, and that we found the answer to coronary artery disease. And that, as you point out, clearly is not the case. There was a recent study that made a big splash. It was called the Bern Rotterdam Registry. And that actually was a registry data of both drug-eluting stents that are available on the market, paclitaxel as well as sirolimus. The big news from that study is that for all comers, that is, if you use drug-eluting stents for all patients on whom you perform a stent procedure and you never use a bare metal stent, what you come up with is that at 1 year, there is a 1.8% stent thrombosis rate in drug-eluting stents. That's for both paclitaxel and sirolimus. At 2 years, that goes up by another 0.6%, and at 3 years, yet another 0.6%, such that at 3 years, we're up to almost 3% right. stent thrombosis. And we don't know what's going to happen at years 4, 5, 6, and beyond, but we do know that, at least according to this one study, it really doesn't plateau out to 3 years.
So the obvious concern then is, can we manipulate that thrombotic process in any way with, for example, anticoagulants, or are there any measures that have been shown or been tried to try to influence this process?
If we go back to bare metal stents initially had a huge closure rate as well. Ultimately, we settled on aspirin and Plavix, dual antiplatelet therapy. Initially, we tried aspirin and ticlopidine, which is also a very effective regimen. We just don't use it anymore because of the risk of TTP and neutropenia, and so you'd have to get serial blood counts. We now use aspirin and Plavix, and we use them with bare metal stents. We use them with drug-eluting stents as well. The real question is, how long do you have to be on aspirin and Plavix dual antiplatelet therapy after implantation of a drug-eluting stent? Well, we initially thought that 3 months of Plavix with the sirolimus-eluting stent and 6 months of Plavix with the paclitaxel-eluting stent was enough. How do we know that was enough? We didn't. We just used those numbers because that was what was used in the original trial. We now believe that longer is better. How long? Again, nobody really knows based on the data. So what many interventional cardiologists do, and this is supported by a consensus statement that was just issued by the American College of Cardiology, 1 year seems to be an appropriate time for dual antiplatelet therapy. That is if you use drug-eluting stents for FDA on-label approved indications. What about when we use drug-eluting stents off-label? And we do so commonly.
Well, I just saw a survey that indicated half of the drug-eluting stents that are put in for off-label indications.
That's exactly right. And probably the reason that is the case is that when drug-eluting stents initially came out, there was a huge surge of enthusiasm because of the restenosis data with probably not enough attention paid to the stent thrombosis issue. For off-label indication, many interventional cardiologists are keeping their patients on dual antiplatelet therapy indefinitely, with unfortunately no great answer as to when to stop.
That does not seem illogical from what you said about the fact that in that longitudinal study, the incidence of thrombosis kept rising approximately 0.8% a year.
That's correct. However, there are risks associated with dual antiplatelet therapy. This is not a completely benign therapy. Say what we know about dual antiplatelet therapy is that over the course of a year, you can expect anywhere from a 0.5 to 1% risk of major bleeding.
So it's almost a toss-up.
It really is not
pick
trivial.
Your poison.
Well, that in some ways, that's true. On the other hand, stent thrombosis, while it does not happen frequently, I mean, if you think about it, 1.7% is a fairly low-frequency event. On the other hand, when it does happen, it can be a disaster. In a patient with stent thrombosis, you can expect a 60 to 80% chance of death or myocardial infarction. So it is not a benign event.
One thing I didn't ask you earlier Why do drug-eluting stents have this propensity to provoke thrombosis late?
Well, that is an interesting question, and it has been studied fairly aggressively. There are a couple of theories as to why this could be. One, it gets at the heart of why drug-eluting stents work in the first place. Perhaps they work too well, and let me explain that. The idea here is to minimize re-endothelialization, or that exuberant response, healing response that we had spoken about earlier. If you do that all too well, you can have not enough re-endothelialization. That leaves struts exposed. There's a foreign body that is exposed to blood.
And never heals.
Right. The other possibility is that there could be a reaction to the actual polymer itself, a sort of hypersensitivity reaction. That is another possibility as to why we have such a propensity to thrombose.
Now, looking forward, because we'd like to bring this down to a practical level, there are several practical questions. Number one, how do you decide what procedure to perform on a patient and what kind of stent to use? Because we're certainly not going back to the era of balloon angioplasty unsupported, except in some occasional cases. But for all practical purposes, everybody gets a stent of one type or another. So how do you decide?
Well, once the decision for PCI, percutaneous coronary intervention, has been made, the decision about whether or not to use a drug-eluting stent has a lot to do with the patient. Well, the one thing that has to be ascertained is the patient's risk of not being on dual antiplatelet therapy for whatever reason in both the long and the short term. For example, if somebody is known to be non-compliant with medications for whatever reason, whether it's for financial reasons or others, that patient probably is not a good candidate for a drug-eluting stent and may be served better with a bare metal stent.
Or, may I say, may be better served with surgery, depending on the anatomy.
Those people who have surgery coming up, elective surgery, for example, well, that is clearly not somebody in whom you would want to put in a drug-eluting stent. We could take a step back and say you might argue you might not want to do any PCI at all in that patient, as we have some data now that many of these patients can come through operation just fine without revascularization, but that is a completely different topic.
Well, let me just summarize by asking you what percentage of people are getting drug-eluting stents.
I think initially the answer to that question was almost everybody was getting drug-eluting stents. This is, we're talking about 2004, 2005, etc. Now, I would say it's somewhere on the order of about 70% nationwide. And I think that we are in that range in this hospital.
Now, I mentioned surgery earlier. I think there's clearly been a national trend towards offering surgery more often than, let us say, 2 or 3 years ago, now that it's recognized that drug-eluting stents are not the answer to every patient's problem.
Well, stenting in general has never been shown to improve mortality, with very few exceptions. And in fact, one exception, and that one exception is in the setting of acute ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. Percutaneous coronary intervention has been shown, if done in a timely fashion by teams with expertise, those patients do derive a mortality benefit over fibrinolytic therapy. Other than that, there has never been shown to be a mortality benefit. There has been shown to be a decrease in the risk of myocardial infarction and revascularization and repeat revascularization, but never a mortality benefit other than the situation that I just mentioned. And in general, the sicker the patient, the better the mortality benefit. That is to say that those people who are in cardiogenic shock with acute ST segment elevation myocardial infarction derive a greater benefit than those people who are, say, for example, KILP class 1.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing all of your insights and experience with us. And we're delighted to have you here as a member of the medical community and look forward to talking with you again here at the journal microphone.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure.